What I see often is that people are scared of AI, and the sentiment is it's growing too fast, it's going to be awful for the world, but there's nothing I can do about it.
The level of data breach has happened to the point where people have become compliant, and there's this sense of learned helplessness of there's nothing I can do. I need to use this technology because it's convenient, but I don't have a say in it.
And I replied saying, actually, the consumers are the ones that hold all the power, but there has to be a recognition, you know, businesses, supply and demand.
It really is a window into the deepest parts of our soul and our spirit and our being, which is an extremely vulnerable place for anyone to be in.
Keza Finch, Dr. Kaushik, welcome back to The Global Affair. Because people loved our last episode so much, and because we felt like we were yet to solve all the problems around AI ethics, it was a collective consensus that we needed to come back for round two. And so maybe to kick us off, I'd love to just hear both of your reflections from our last conversation and get a pulse on, you know, what you feel we missed and what we need to dive into in the episode today.
So just really quickly, my name is Marquesa Finch. I am a venture capitalist and fintech founder who's worked in blockchain and DeFi and alternative finance. And then prior to that was in digital health. And I guess more importantly, I'm also involved with Intruth Technologies, both as an investor and also on the Research and Ethics Board. And we'd love to share with you all some of the things that we've been talking about. So in part one of this discussion, I think we started to touch on what the problem was between quantum computing and blockchain, and therefore largely AI and blockchain. And I think we touched on sort of the high-level contradictions that exist within the technology, but didn't really get into the details of how in the vein of this discussion, how it affects our work at Intruth. So I think we're going to do that today, hopefully.
Thanks, Marquesa. And of course, just a shout out if to anyone that's listening to this that didn't listen to part one, I seriously encourage you to go and listen to that episode and then come back and listen to this one. Kaushik.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, just bridging off Marquesa as well. Very quick introduction. I'm Dr. Kaushik Ram, a neuroscientist and chief of science at Intruth Technologies. And in the previous episode, we talked about the evolutionary perspective on evolution of technology. And this is really what sparked an interest in looking at the arms race happening within technology itself. So we think of technology having a constant pace of evolution, but at the same time, if you look at how technology has evolved, some technologies die out, some become irrelevant, some become ineffective. And so these are some of the things I'd like to explore on, for example, how quantum computing and blockchain are in contradictory evolutionary paths. So just expanding on that, I think, would be a interesting thing to explore.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you, Kaushik. I think one of the things that really stood out to me, Marquesa, which was a point that you raised in the last episode, you also said this is something you love to talk about a lot. So I want to give more of that space to the idea of incentive alignment. And, you know, we explored incentive alignment as it relates to public health, but maybe we can also have a bit of a discourse around how incentive alignment currently is or maybe isn't working in the tech space, which is, you know, heavily now unregulated. Governments likely won't be able to keep up with the regulation process when it comes to wellness technologies and what that means, and actually what we can do as a sector, what needs to happen for us to ensure, you know, that these technologies are actually being built in public interest. So that's a big conversation. Let's see how far we get in the next hour. And, you know, I might pass it to you, Marquesa, to kick us off with some initial thoughts on, incentive alignment and also biometrics, the ethical considerations of biometrics and how biometrics can be used as a 2FA, which I know is something that we've talked about a lot. And to someone that doesn't know what a 2FA is, a two-factor authentication process, how could we actually use our own bodies as a encryption layer to protect our data in the future?
Absolutely. Happy to kick things off. My disclaimer first is that I am not a trained engineer technologist, so there will be a limit to what I can even discuss on this podcast. But I think, Nicole, you have some exciting, potential guests coming up who could probably dig deeper into that. But with that said, so around technology and incentive alignment, first, technology does three things very well. It amplifies, it simplifies, and it creates access. So if you think of any technology that you know use in the home or at work, it does one or multiple of those things better than the traditional way that things were done. And so with that said, there's also this concept of incentive alignment, which we see all throughout our lives, really, in every fact of our lives, whether it's where we live, where we work, and where we play. And the idea there is that in order for a goal to be met where multiple parties are involved, you typically need to understand what is motivating each one of those parties, and those parties all need to align to, you know, one or more incentives. And so that's what we call incentive alignment. So whatever is motivating each party to work towards the goal, they can be different or the same, but they're congruent with each other. And so with that said, you know, we work in digital health, in truth. We work in AI and in blockchain at InTruth. And so we need to find the incentive alignment between a number of different factors. And those are the different technologies that we use. So you can consider technology as one factor, but then, you know, stratify within that area too by technology type. The user, also the same there too, which could be aggregated as, you know, one factor, but also can be stratified between, either the patient / the user whose emotions, you know, we're tracking, or someone that is helping that person use their emotions. And then the third factor I would say would be the company itself. And so, you know, how do we figure out a way where the business processes, the vision, and the mission that we're using it in truth are aligning those incentives so we're all working towards the same goal that benefits everyone?
What about other stakeholders beyond that, just out of curiosity? So you've named, you know, us as a product, you know, the broader company, and then the end user. Like, I often think about what are the peripheral stakeholders that, you know, aren't even stakeholders yet, like governments, health agencies, insurance companies that want the data.
I would probably also group them in the user category, meaning that if anyone or anybody that touches the data, I would consider a user. That's just my personal labeling.
That makes sense, yeah.
But I agree. There are a number of different institutions, a number of different user types that could come in contact with this data, you know, and use it for good.
They all have different agendas too, which I think is important.
Very different.
Yeah,
very different, which is where the incentive alignment becomes even more important.
Yeah,
maybe I'll just start with the one that's most relevant to what it is that we're building and what we're talking about today. And that is, how do we ensure that users, so I'm going to use users in this sense as the person whose emotions are being monitored. How does the user, how are they able to benefit from the tracking of their emotions in order to do behavior change for awareness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whatever those benefits are? And what are their concerns around how that data is being monitored and used and distributed? There's also how the technological side around the engine or the machine work that is making that possible. I'm also going to throw in their policy, because none of this exists outside of the, you know, exactly, the vector of policy. Policy is sort of the umbrella that encompasses everything that dictates how we can actually make this machine move. And then in truth itself, around how this, how does this data is being used to push the mission on. So that's the big question right now, right? And I think, Nicole, you wanted to talk specifically about how we integrate technology for the use of privacy, and the type of technology that's available to us today, the type of technology that's being built today for tomorrow, and how do they work together in order to help us align our incentive around protecting user data?
Correct. Yeah.
Well, we can get deeply into that between AI and blockchain, which are two technologies that in truth uses. In part one, we talked about how AI/quantum computing is contradictory to the infrastructure of blockchain, because inevitably what it does is that it cracks the cryptography that is used to ensure the security of the blockchain itself, and therefore the protection of the chain. So with that said, I don't think we got into maybe what the industry is doing to address that issue. And so we can start talking about that. Currently, there is an effort to come up with, I should say, technologies, which seems to be called in aggregate post-quantum strategies or post-quantum cryptography. And so this is a set of math, really. It's a set of strategies that are combating the issue of unlocking blockchain, specifically public keys, with quantum computing and the volume of compute that it uses. And so there are some companies. I just in the disclaimer sense, there are a number of models, if you will, mathematical models that are outlined around, or I should say, that have been identified in order to combat this issue around quantum computing and blockchain. I think maybe for the sake of this discussion, we don't get into them too deeply, because I would probably butcher it anyways.
I want to pick up the pieces and come back to this, but you know, firstly, there's these multiple stakeholders where, you know, in an ideal world, kind of a utopian world, all of their incentives would align, right? And we could create this super powerful technology that is strictly in public interest. I think the first curiosity that would be running through listeners' minds is, well, why doesn't that happen? Why does the alignment of incentives start to diverge? How does that actually happen? What are the different agendas of different stakeholders within these kind of technological ecosystems? And then where might it be sort of too altruistic to suggest that that incentive alignment could be created? And can we use protection layers like a biometric 2FA to kind of supplement where those alignments may not occur, which I think, you know, is a nice segue as well into Koshik's kind of the questions he's posing around how do we make sure that technology is supporting our evolution in the right sense and not making us a commodity. So maybe we can break that down first for the listener.
You know, the sensitive thing about emotional data is that it gets, it really is a window into the deepest parts of our soul and our spirit and our being, which is an extremely vulnerable place for anyone to be in. With that said, now you're layering on top of that the fact that someone else will not only has access to see how you're feeling in your most vulnerable state, but is now going to use that data for who knows what, namely to help you, as it's been communicated
sometimes
to you. But yeah, and at that, you know, I think we should throw in the word they're try to help you,
right?
Because we know, you know, medicine doesn't get everything right. But then you layer on top of that, that if one person has access and a second person can, a third and a fourth. And
there's a commoditization that happens, you know, beyond that. And actually, one of our most read articles was an article we put up on our blog a few weeks ago about how emotion detection is happening without our even awareness. And there was a use case that we referenced. It was KFC in a country, I can't remember which country it was, that was using facial recognition and sort of the infliction of reaction in facial features to manipulate pricing. And this was something that we had so many people reach out to us being like, oh my God, is this actually happening? And this is an example basically of where your insight into your emotional state, your level of reactivity, these kinds of things are being manipulated to chop and change commercial interests of big corporations.
Yeah. And that seems, it almost seems like a invasive violation of your right to just exist as you see fit. That is a scary anecdote. If it's being scaled. But what I will say is in that vulnerable space, the idea of other people being able to use it, that is someone other than the person you have deemed you have deemed your healthcare provider or the person that can use that data, that permissioned person. Then we get into, how are you going to protect my privacy? How are you going to protect my data? And I don't think we're actually starting at a baseline level when it comes to privacy in our society. I think we've had privacy issue in tech over issue, where now our baseline's kind of moved up to this heightened state of, concern, collective concern, in which now we're having to work harder as tech companies to earn the consumer-based trust around privacy. Going back to incentive alignment, it's really important to communicate the technology that has been selected, and I should say intelligently selected to handle that problem, to how to communicate how that technology protects users' privacy to the consumer base. And then three, to address any potential risks down the road or the timeline that may come up. And the contradiction between quantum computing and blockchain is one of them. It's not a discussion that's happening in closed door labs. It's a discussion that's happening, in the public sphere. And so users are aware of this issue. And I'd even say even those issues that haven't come to light yet in the general public probably do need to be identified and addressed so we can get ahead of it before there's this sort of, collective paranoia brewing. But the alignment there, what I'll say is that there's a shared interest to protect privacy. Now the question is, how do we protect that privacy? And I think you're really thinking about two things. You're thinking about what is the technological capability and what is the political capability. And we could probably have another discussion, or maybe we do want to address it on this particular podcast. Which one is harder?
Or can technology be designed actually in a way that it's just baked in from the beginning? And, I had a question, and I want to let Kaushik speak in just a minute, but I was pitching to an investor just last week, and he was like, I'm really, in his words, passionate about data sovereignty. I wish the world would be more passionate about data sovereignty. But the behavioral reality is, for the most part, that people will just tick the T's and C's. And, they say they care, but their behavior sort of suggests otherwise. And my rebuttal to that was, I think, if the perceived convenience outweighs the difficulty of having to learn about data privacy or kind of make a decision around technological use that separates you from mainstream kind of society, then, I do agree that people are likely to concede in those situations. But if there was a company or a series of companies that made their user experience equally frictionless and the user could choose their data security, privacy, and sovereignty as well, that to me would be the no-brainer choice. And the consumer would have an opinion about that if put kind of on a silver platter to them.
I guess the one thing I was thinking around is that assuming you have a perfect technological strategy slash solution, it could still be compromised by the policies that it operates under. And so, you know, what I mean, and vice versa, you know, policy could be strong, tech could be weak. And so I think that's a continuous discussion that we need to have as technologists and as users of technology is, you know, where is the happy medium? And if one part is compromising the other, then we need to speak up and we need to participate. What I see often is that people are scared of AI, and the sentiment is, it's growing too fast. It's going to be awful for the world, but there's nothing I can do about it. And I think that's maybe not the best approach to take. I think there has to be some participation by everyone, even if it's just expressing sentiment.
That was a question we got from your last episode, Marquezo, was like the comment said something to the effect, and shout out to the person that put the comment on the video, was this just feels like, you know, Armageddon's kind of inevitable in this situation. And as a consumer, like, what can we even do? Because conglomerates are owning this, you know, in such an extreme way that I think the point that they were trying to make is, what realistically can the consumer do? And I replied saying, actually, the consumers are the ones that hold all the power, but there has to be a recognition, you know, business is supply and demand. And unless the consumer demands something different, you know, then yeah, these conglomerates will remain inextricably powerful. And yeah, Kaushik, do you have a perspective on this?
Yeah, definitely. I think looking at this from a evolutionary perspective, the data breaches have been a ongoing thing in the tech world. So we are in 2025 now, and the number of times, for example, we have been tracked, and for example, something as little as selecting cookies was not available in the 2010s, right? We were being tracked to the nth degree, and then policy change, and now we can select how much we want websites to track us. And so the level of data breach has happened to the point where people have become compliant, and there's this sense of learned helplessness of, there's nothing I can do. I need to use this technology because it's convenient, but I don't have a say in it. And that is a very, it is a very weak position to be in. And it's not for, especially people coming into tech right now, the Gen Alpha and younger of the Gen Z, they are being assimilated into this world of tech without knowing what it was like to have those rights in the first place. And so for us to re-engineer the technology and give back those rights is, first of all, a cultural shift. And there's education piece that has to happen there, because especially in wearable technology, there are biometric data policies, neurosecurity policies, yet most people are not educated enough to understand why these data breaches are so, it exposes so much vulnerability. And especially when we're dealing with emotion data, at a human-to-human level, that is one thing. So what if governments have access to this data? What if insurance companies have access to this data? But on top of that, now we have to contend with another exposure, which is, what if LLMs have exposure to this data? And how will that manipulate the human species? And so the degree of concern around our most vulnerable aspects and how we can so easily be manipulated, especially with the first contact with AI, which was a race to the bottom of brainstem, which basically commodified dopamine hits. And now we've seen an entire generation and the side effects of all of that. So now we have exposure to wearables, which is extracting so many physiological responses. Some of it we don't even, are aware of consciously. And that is being mined for commercial use. This is where the education piece comes in and why we need to educate the consumer to understand what is helpful for them in the first place and what is harmful for them in terms of how much they're willing to expose.
One of the things that, to all the super valuable points that you've just made, Kaushik, one of my, I guess, concerns that comes out of this, Marqueza, is these are all very real risks. Like we can see, right? The three of us can see, the Whole and Truth team can see the dystopia that may be created if emotional data was consistently mined with zero regulation, not in the public interest, but to drive commercialization. You know, I like to say rather than becoming precision medicine, it would become precision marketing, and people would just lose an entire ability to have free thought because their emotions were consistently being weaponized against them. But that is, at the moment, the most profitable avenue for these kinds of companies to go down. And if we remain reliant on venture to fund these companies, like, let's talk about the incentive alignment there. Because if you say to a venture capitalist, I need 10 years to give you a return, but if you give me 10 years, I'm going to give you an even greater return than what a company that was willing to compromise on their ethics could give you in 5. But venture sits back and says, well, I can't give you that. I need my return in the time that I need my return. And it just becomes this kind of circular issue where funders' expectation is not actually aligned with building these technologies in a considered ethical way. And, you know, realistically, what do we do about that? What are some of the things that we can do to change the criteria in which substantial funders in our world are pouring money into these technologies without consideration of the consequence?
I'm glad you brought that up, Nicole. It's actually pretty timely. If we just shift for 2 seconds to a peripheral topic around how the structure of venture capital could be changing this year. There are a number of bills right now that are being deliberated in our legislative bodies. 4 just passed the House, and so they're on their way to the Senate. And if they pass there, then they're on the way to the president's desk to potentially be signed into law. I won't go through each one of them, but the aggregate of all these will essentially do a number of things. One, it's going to create more accredited investors in the U.S., so anyone will be able to become an accredited investor by passing an SEC administered test.
That's cool. So it opens up more capital.
Increase in number of Reg D capital, of accredited capital, which means more angel funds, just more funds in general. So increase in number of capital to raise. Great for founders who are looking to access more capital that way. And in the last few years have been tough. But more importantly, funds will now be able to invest in other assets like fund of funds, secondaries, which is really important to what you were saying about length of time to liquidity, Nicole, and they'll be able to invest in other assets outside of equities, just private equity and private companies. And the reason why that matters is because funds now have new avenues in which to access liquidity. And so that tension that you mentioned, Nicole, that stress that a lot of VCs put on their portfolio companies to build and to be profitable, to eventually be liquid, that these laws could help that. The other thing I want to bring up too, that's relevant here is, anyone investing in a health technology or that's a digital health investor should be absolutely aware that the time to profit and the time to liquidity is much longer than I would say any other vertical out there. If you're dealing with healthcare in the United States.
If you want to be sort of a clinically recognized technology, just to sort of make that really clear, something that's ingrained, embedded as a med tech or software as a medical device. Yeah.
Something that's adopted as what we call standard of care or standard of practice. And so it takes an incredibly long time to do that in this country because of the regulations that we have. Now, if one is successful in doing that, then the product or the company stays in the standard of care practice for decades. And I'll use Epic as one of them. Epic is essentially a medical tracking tool that most of healthcare uses. Epic's been around ever since I've started my career, and I'm, in my 40s. So these things stay around in the industry for a long time, but the time it takes to get there, it takes a while and it's capital intensive. So what does that mean for, again, going back to incentive aligning, yet another incentive that we need to be aware of is who are the funders or who are the backers that are pulling the strings behind the scenes of the companies who are building this technology? And what does that mean for you, the user? Those strings that are being pulled behind the curtain from what you can see as the user is having a direct effect on the type of product or service that you're using, and it's having a direct effect on the quality of care that you're receiving. And so it's important for us to know how those things work. And that is something that I would say 99% of the population does not understand.
Well, a lot of the time it's not even visible, right? Like high level, like an investor's stock is sitting in a parent company, which isn't public facing anyway, So there's kind of layers on layers of layers that create a lack of transparency. And so I can hear the questions that our listeners might have around like, well, how do we become educated on these things?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm hoping with these new policies that education will follow. That's a big hope. In the work that I do in my company at Perium, we're education first. And that's namely because we are trying to galvanize the general public around angel investing and having more direct access and engagement with companies building this technology. And so education has to be first as you're activating a brand new investor pool. Bringing it back to the topic at hand around incentive alignment, privacy is an issue. Privacy is an issue. I think intent can also be an issue if not transparent. And then future, I would say future risk, and that's something that's hard to talk about. For the saying that you don't know what you don't know.
Hard to quantify. Yeah.
It is hard to predict what risks will pop up in the future. I think some you can forecast, others you can't. A class 6 pandemic like COVID is something we couldn't have forecasted. So how do we prepare for these black swan scenarios, as they say? And I think this is where technology can help us. But I'll pause there and see if Kaushik has anything to add.
I guess my question to you, Kaushik, as it relates to this, is maybe there's, investors listening that kind of have dug in their heels and said, you know what, no, like the most important thing is profit. I'm not really interested in opening my mind beyond 10x returns in a certain period of time. Maybe you can speak to, what the broader implication is on our world in such a way that it could create a repositioning to some of the people that hold those levers of power.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the power that technology companies have is on a constantly shifting ground, right? As public interest and awareness matures, tech companies have to realign to the new interests. So incentive alignment is a constantly moving target. And we have seen this, for example, during the pandemic, there was so much censorship happening and the public trust in tech eroded very, very quickly. And in order to bring that back, for example, X introduced community notes, and that was then adopted by Meta as well. So there's so many ways in which the breach of trust requires a shift in mindset for big tech conglomerates. And further to that, like as investors, if you cannot predict black swan events, it's very important to diversify your portfolio. And if you just invest in one type of tech company, then of course that limits your ability to stay afloat in black swan events. And so this is, to equalize the playing field, you have to actually have a very open mindset in investments as well.
Here's one future potential risk that we actually know about, but how big of a risk it may or may not be is still unknown. And that is, I call it the silent risk of AI and blockchain. But the commonality of these two technologies is that they both use an intense amount of energy.
Compute.
Yeah, but so for compute power, AI relies on compute power servers, which use an insane amount of energy, water, cooling, et cetera, et cetera. But so does blockchain. Every time there is one more link welded to that chain, it requires a system of events to happen that's powered by energy. And so when blockchain first came around with crypto, Bitcoin and crypto and blockchain first came around, that was one of the issues, was the amount of energy that it would take to build these chains and at scale. Ethereum was a big one people were talking about back then. And so here we are again with a different type of technology that also requires a lot of energy. And now we're trying to build products that use both. So, I think in this discussion, certainly around privacy, and I think indirectly energy does relate to privacy. Because say we do have a lack of enough power to be able to run everything that we need to do for both AI and blockchain, what does that mean to the integrity of the architecture of a lot of different technologies?
What would look like on a sort of an actual societal level, if we reached a mm-hmm. point where energy became that scarce, what would that actually, how would that play out on a global stage, do you think?
I mean, in its simplest form, technology wouldn't be able to run. So, we could not power the processes that are needed.
Homes, internet, banking.
Oh, yeah. On an industry level, absolutely. I mean, Kaushik talked about diversification, and I think diversification of tech is also important. Like, single point of failure is a real thing. And we've seen it happen over and over and over again. A number of the privacy breaches that Kaushik mentioned earlier in the podcast I believe were a result, some of them were a result of single point of failure. And so I think we have to be thinking about these risks that we know of and extrapolating them to potentials that include new factors like consumption of energy and increasing volume of tech that uses this energy to understand, you know, where our weaknesses are. And again, this like annoying little thing coming out of nowhere called policy really affects that. I mean, you know, hopefully everyone's paying attention to the news and what's going on with tariffs and NATO. And hopefully just, you know, I hope most people have a basic understanding about, you know, how we buy and sell energy in this country. We don't make all of our energy. We have to buy it from somewhere and from usually from another country. And that can get a little hairy if we're not getting along with said country. And this, you know, this is just common all over the world. So again, policy and politics has to be consideration for every single company, especially now. And, you know, for a lot of major corporations, it is. They have internal policy teams and they're following this all the time and they're participating to try to make business a little bit easier, try to have a seat at the table. And, you know, when it comes to AI, blockchain and healthcare, I think we absolutely need to.
I think this is a really important point, right? Because one of the common arguments in AI and technology right now is, well, governments are just not going to be able to regulate. So like, just like, let's not even consider them in the conversation. But although they might not be able to, say, regulate how biotechnology data is sold, for instance, they are regulating the amount of access to energy that we have, which would ultimately be the determining factor as to the survival of technology anyway. And I think that, you know, even I haven't thought about it from that perspective, although I have considered the demands of compute in AI quite a lot, but the role that, you know, government is integral to making sure that countries have democratized energy supply, which is a big part of the arms race right now, actually, of AI.
Absolutely. You know, if you've been a founder before, you either know by building or you've been told by those who are around you that you should try to control every major part of your core business, whether you build it yourself or that there are so many vendors that you can choose from that if, you know, the one you were using or the two you were using, you know, went belly up, it wouldn't be a problem. And that's really what we have to think about here. To give some sample anecdotes, you know, there was a single point of failure, if you will, with baby formula not too long ago, where somehow we didn't know, or maybe some did, that most of the world's baby formula was made in one factory. So if that one factory has an issue, we all have a global issue. And, you know, how scary that it had to be nourishment for some of the most vulnerable humans on our planet. But, you know, these things happen, and they actually happen a lot.
Who had the monopoly on baby formula, just out of curiosity?
What was that?
Who had the monopoly on baby formula?
I can't remember the factory's name. They were in China.
It was a Chinese factory.
It was a Chinese factory who somehow over time had just gained a monopoly on baby formula. You know, I don't know if it came out that the CDC knew or didn't know about this, but they're supposed to be monitoring that, because that is, that can be considered a national security issue. I think it was elevated to a national security issue.
Wow.
Yeah, don't quote me on that, but if I'm remembering it correctly. But again, you know, extrapolate those issues to a number of things that, you know, are vulnerable to us. And, you know, we're actually building a product that is high on that scale of vulnerability when it comes to consumer use. So What are the single points of failure? What are the potential risks in the future that we can maybe even slightly illuminate today? And then more importantly, what are the risks that we can actually mitigate today?
Yeah, energy is a really big one, actually. And this is perhaps why there's a certain push towards nuclear. And there are certain countries around the world that are harboring a lot of nuclear energy, and that is being exported quite widely, Australia being one of them. So it is, I guess, as companies demand more compute, blockchain, AI, and at the same time, we've got climate activists fighting against that, that also are very heavily reliant on technology. There is a conflict of interest that is, you know, comes back to incentive alignment. When I speak to a lot of Gen Z, climate change is one of the number one issues, along with food supply chains as well. So these two things are very much correlated: climate change, food supply. But both of those things are inherently reliant on technology, and so it becomes a very difficult problem to solve in terms of how do you find mutual interests when, you know, politics also comes into influencing young minds. And this is where, you know, the education piece comes in even more, because previous generations have been met with the same issues, yet have, instead of solving it, they've passed it on to the next generation. And so the effect keeps compounding generation after generation, to the point where now, if we don't address this issue upfront, it might not be available for future generations.
I think the first step towards incentive alignment is collaboration. Something that I have actually never felt we do well in this country, between public and private, but consumer and public, or consumer and private. And I'll just give like a quick example. I used to travel to Italy when I was younger, post-college. And the volume of discussion amongst young people in Italy around politics and their opinions and how they think things should be, and the problems that they're seeing, and
they're engaged,
compare and contrast to another country, was wild to me as a young 20-something year old coming from America, because my friends and I were not having these conversations, not to that level. Mm-hmm. And it really just highlighted for me that discussion, engagement, collaboration can happen. It absolutely can happen. And it can happen between consumer and public and private. So that triad, it absolutely can. But it takes an initiative. And maybe this is where industry education to the general public comes in. Maybe that's the first step to make people comfortable in speaking out, because they now they know a little bit more and they're a little bit more comfortable with the subject, and they can be better versed at communicating their opinions or concerns around a new topic. But then it really has to be an open discussion between us, the consumer, and the people that are writing our policies. I just don't think that there is enough communication there. And I don't know if it's getting better or worse with each generation. It's definitely different. I just don't know if the volume's increasing or decreasing, or if people are hearing one another. Maybe that's the other problem. Maybe there is discussion happening, but no one's actually listening.
Well, the issues, right, as we know, is that, unlike kind of when we were going through university, there weren't any echo chambers, right? So discourse was the way that people would sharpen their opinions. But now we have, you know, I feel like people's political dispositions are heavily influenced by the content consumption and algorithmic kind of echo chambers that we're living in, which is kind of unprecedented. You know, those that really didn't start to emerge until, say, 2015, 2016.
Now, this is something that I believe in truth is in a very strong position of illuminating on, because this is one of the things that I want to actually gain insight on is generation level emotion regulation. And if we consider, you know, millennials above, like Gen X, boomers, inherently because of discourse, we had to hold two different opinions and then come up with our own opinion on something. And this quality, which is sometimes frowned upon with younger generations, called critical thinking, is, you know, it has not matured enough to be able to have discourse. And so often, if you're not in the right echo chamber, you will not be having contradictory discussions. And so,
is there instead an echo chamber that invites contradiction? Is that
that's exactly
how do I get my algorithm to promote contradictory views? I would love that.
Yeah,
that's true. If there is one, let me know.
I want in on that echo chamber. Other than confusing my algorithm by like liking things from different sides of a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of it is by design now, right? So. Mm-hmm. It makes it very, very difficult to even develop a sense of critical thought. Since if you have a thought, you can find an echo chamber that reinforces it. And so that reinforcement learning is being, especially in how the brain acquires belief systems, is becoming solidified and consolidated. And the strong opinions are so crystallized that no other point of view can be heard. And so one of the things that, you know, I'd really like in truth to be able to diagnose is emotion regulation better in younger or older generations? And if so, does that facilitate better communication? Does it facilitate better dialogue and the ability to confront and contradict and use critical thought to come up with your own opinions? This is something that I feel is not something unique to Intruth. It's happening across all companies, the loss of critical thought.
Mm-hmm. We have critical thought. What do you mean? We don't have issues with critical thought.
The overuse of LLMs is actually inherent in all companies now. So that over time will erode critical thought as well. And so I'm very conscious of this. And this is something that especially for the younger generations that are heavily reliant on, it's the responsibility of companies to actually be able to extract thought from them.
There's a big values alignment piece in this too, right? Because you have like leaders of LLM companies, like Sam Altman has said publicly, like, oh, well, we'll just come up with better problems to solve. Like the disposition is very much like, stop caring about the problems that these machines now solve for us because we don't have to solve them. So just like move on. And there's not actually a value placed on the efforting required to personally solve these problems anymore. And I think that like in the vein of talking about incentive alignment, that's pretty considerable because I would say actually the majority of Silicon Valley and the majority of consumers for the most part actually are not that interested in solving those problems or having critical debate. And I agree that it's now on steroids more than it ever has been because of the rise of these technologies and because of echo chambers. But still, I think historically, humans haven't really been the best at like extending empathy and compassion to someone that believes different things, thinks different things, is challenging our power or ego in some way. But agree that this really like is needed more than ever to be able to find common ground so that we can draw some boundaries around potential risks to our, you know, humanity, core humanity, to the future of our world. But it's an inner journey, right? And this is like, even when I was working in government, where I felt like politicians were so wrong in their focal point, because the disposition of the questions they would ask is, how do we get people to do this? You know, how do we force through, yeah, you know, and not to say policy and things aren't without their merit, but the thing that I would see is you can make something illegal, but people will still participate. Like you can say, all right, it's a violation to infringe on someone's human rights or to express racism or to express homophobia or whatever it is. People still will. So it's not the real antidote, right, to those issues. The real antidote is someone actually evolving and caring about their own personal development enough to move their level of consciousness to a place where that becomes kind of core to who they are. It's a very, very complex thing to solve, because you're basically saying we want humanity to individually participate in the evolution of their self-awareness, in the elevation of their consciousness at scale, in order to really have this problem that we're pointing to resolve itself in a meaningful way.
I think it is complex, Nicole, but I think we as a global society can move the needle significantly. But again, I don't think there is enough incentive in a lot of countries to do so. And that is meeting people's basic needs. If you meet people's really basic needs, and if that's what I'm, and by basic needs, I mean adequate housing, food, education, upward mobility, happiness. So going back to the emotional part, feeling content.
You can evolve up Maslow's communication, so to speak.
You've already taken care of a lot of that complexity. And when people have their basic needs met, they now have emotional and intellectual and mindfulness freedom to start thinking about these things that they couldn't before because they were so desperate in solving basic need issues. And, you know, this is what's been said a lot about, you know, our current billionaires, too, is the theory around that. Like, they grew up with privilege and had their basic needs met, and they still do. And so they can start thinking of these crazy things to build because they have that space. They're privileged to enjoy that headspace, that emotional space. And some countries, you know, especially in Europe, do a better job than most at doing that. And so, you know, you get these high happiness scores, but I think a lot with that also comes these, you know, I don't know if it's been measured, but they're certainly known for being more empathetic or having more value on empathy, having more value.
Usually more socialist political structures, right?
Yeah, they're countries that in public health, we used to call them socially redistributive policies.
Yeah, meaning, Finland's a great example. You know,
yeah, all the Nordic countries are great at that. But they have policies that redistribute resources in mass to everyone, regardless of background. I feel like that's an easy thing to address, but there isn't a lot of incentive in a lot of countries to do that, certainly not in this country.
I think this raises a really interesting point, Marquezer, and I mean, it's not a new debate, right? Like, what political structure is optimal to be able to sort of climb the ladder of Maslow's hierarchy? And we are kind of reaching right now with AI companies and companies that are likely companies and individuals that now have the capacity to become trillionaires for the first time in human history. Like, that is totally unprecedented levels of wealth and power and influence in single individuals. We're mm-hmm. seeing the absolute pinnacle of capitalism. And I think we're going to have to make a decision in that. Like, is this is this what we want to continue to perpetuate, or do we want to draw a line in the sand and maybe reevaluate our values as a world? And I mean, that poses way bigger questions around kind of the very fabrics of our economy, you know, the political class within Western countries. Like, it's a really substantial conversation to start going down that rabbit hole. But yeah, I mean, I asked this question, capitalism at what cost? And I asked that question living in San Francisco more than I ever have, like going to Palo Alto and, you know, meeting in buildings where, you know, billionaires were a dime a dozen, to then going home to downtown San Francisco and seeing, you know, 100 fentanyl addicts on my street is an extreme. You know, coming from a country like Australia is more socialist. Like, the class divide is not that extreme. And when you're confronted with it, it really is like, wow, this is the cost of capitalism at its finest. And in order to cope with that, I think many people that live in cities like San Francisco just have to become numb. You know, you do kind of lose your humanity. I remember first moving to San Francisco and being really confronted by it. After a couple of years, it just becomes, you know, part of the course to walk to your morning coffee.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I will say is, you know, we're a global population of brilliant people. And with that, there have already been a number of brilliant ideas on how to rectify and, again, incentive align this problem. One of them that I'd be remiss not to mention was outlined by economist Mariana Mazzucato. She wrote The Entrepreneurial State. And she proposes that all tech companies that use some technology that was heavily backed by the federal government or any government, like the NIH, for example, or the Department of Defense, or any you know, government department that gave money for an initial research to the products that they're building, should give or issue some equity. It could be a small amount to the government out of their company. So, for example, GPS was initially government funded. It actually got to the point where it could be marketed largely through government funded. And now Apple takes advantage of that. The internet as well. AI too. I mean, a number, like I would say most of the technology was government funded at one point. And so if you consider the government to be an investor in those, in the, that technology, an investor in those companies, then why shouldn't they own a base point or two in these companies? If you imagine 1% of OpenAI, 1% of Apple, 1% of Amazon, you're essentially paying for a lot of the budget that we need every year to run basic things like education. And so every year there's a budget crisis because we don't have enough money. Why are we not taking advantage of these companies who are creating these localized trillionaires and creating even more divide and creating even even more friction within our societal levers? Why not distribute that wealth that really should have been done because it's justified based off of the initial investment that was put in to be able to fund a lot of these things that we need?
So it's like some buffer to complete privatization, but still allowing companies for the most part to remain private.
Right. So, yeah. You know, you essentially don't issue like a board seat or controlling rights to the federal government in these companies. But it allows them a vehicle for a return on their investment that we all benefit from, by the way, because they're paying for our roads and our schools and, you know, our infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And who knows? Maybe it even has a positive effect on how much taxes we have to pay. I think the ideas are out there.
Adoption.
I think that is the biggest problem is us. The biggest problem is us and the fact that we don't get out of our way because we have a number of belief systems that are in contradiction to one another. And so, you know, how do we alleviate that? How do we talk about new
ideas? How do we get
ideas?
On the same team? Yeah. And like right, what forum as well, because that's, you know, the global population is so distributed. So creating a forum where that continuity of conversation, because I think a lot of these forums do exist, right, Marquesa? Like people go to big conferences and events, whether it's, you know, Davos or this or that, but the continuity of being able to then take those plans and actually integrate it, you know, maybe that's actually something that AI can help with more than anything, is continuity of project management to bring more coherence to very complex cross-collaborative ideas.
Yeah. Yes. It definitely, it can certainly help there in connecting the dots. But even before that, I think there needs to be, you know, some sort of human empathy connection around there is no them and there is no us.
Yeah, totally.
And that there is we, and we need to start from that place, because I know sometimes those conversations don't even have the chance to start, because there's already a barrier between, well, you just mentioned increasing taxes or cutting taxes. You must be over there. And I've now put up a wall to not listen to you anymore. That I think it's that kind of behavior that we really need to address first.
I absolutely agree on that. In fact, what we're seeing now in the world is what happens when that starting point is not there. And I think Europe, as you guys discussed it, especially Nordic countries, were a good example of mass adoption, basically. And then over time, especially in recent years, the empathy has been abused to the point where now in those very safe Nordic countries where we did see high happiness scores, are now seeing parallel communities. And the most extreme version of that was when I saw when I was in South Africa, in Johannesburg. The parallel communities are actually divided by estates. And in fact, the people on the street who live outside the estate live a completely different life to the ones that are within estates. And when Nicole was talking about San Francisco, if things continue to go on the route that it is going on, I do see the US going down parallel communities as well. And that would be greatly unfortunate. And so in truth, if we have the opportunity right now to shed light on how much emotional blocks people have in terms of having meaningful conversations, have a starting point to begin a conversation. It is, you know, a moment in time, like this Goldilocks opportunity for us to actually, you know, align humanity. We may not be aligned in every aspect, but at least we can have conversations that build bridges for us to move forward. And especially for newer countries, there's something also in terms of brain development that I've seen. Old world countries have been seeing a decline in IQ levels, while new world countries, especially, for example, South Korea, have been seeing an increase in IQ levels. And that's because the intellectual development does reach a point of saturation. and countries that are just becoming more and more westernized, they're on the upward direction of that growth. And so right now we do have the opportunity to harmonize across different countries and bring basically cohesion towards different, you know, diverse ways of thinking, which at the moment, I think, because of so much political interference, communities are feeling divided and are going into parallel societies, which if you're living on the same land and are part of the same country, a citizen of a particular country, that shouldn't really be the case. You should be proud of the country that you live in. And if there is parallel communities happening within a country, then, you know, the direction that is heading towards is what we've witnessed in South Africa. And that is not a very, first of all, profitable, and secondly, safe country to be in.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, when you were actually a part of it in the last summit that we ran, Mokeza, I for 4 years in a row ran a summit called the Global Unity Summit. And the whole intent of the summit was to interview people and start dialogue around the idea of unity. And I have to say, like, the consensus, there would have been probably more than 100 people that were interviewed over those years and asked that question, all very intelligent people. And in one way or another, basically every single one of them said, unity is not sameness. It's the ability to withstand difference. It's the ability to stay together in our differences and tolerate and empathize with difference. And I know, like, having those conversations for me personally was really moving to understand that is the maturation actually of human society, is the ability to not disconnect and other humans, dehumanize other humans because of a difference of belief. And one thing that I hope in truth uncovers and shows the world is that on an autonomic level, on an emotional level, humans are the same. There's more of what makes us the same than what separates us. And more often than not, two opposing positions to any conversation or argument are actually experiencing the same thing emotionally, but they have a very different idea about how something should be. And so I guess on that note, I'd love to invite both of you to give some closing comments and maybe some questions, points of reflection to leave our listeners with today.
I think my calls to action remain the same. I believe I mentioned it in part one of this podcast, but my primary call to action to everyone would be to participate, to figure out what that participation looks for you. It could be very different for everyone. And it could be as simple as reading an extra article or blog or two around AI, maybe in your industry, or maybe how it's specifically related to you, you know, all the way up to getting involved into boards like this, to speaking to your legislators about it, or getting involved in some type of AI organization. That would be my call to action. I will say that the potential for AI can be revolutionary. It can also be high risk, but we shouldn't let that risk paralyze our ability to move the direction into an area of high, healthy potential. So that would be my primary call to action, I would say. My secondary call to action is just going to reflect on the last point that the three of us just talked about, and that is considering not just being tolerant of those that are different from you, but also open. To me, I don't think tolerance is quite enough.
That's true. I agree.
It's the first step. I don't think tolerance is quite enough.
Tolerance isn't
enough. And I say that Yes, yes. I say that because tolerance could just mean, well, I'm not going to react to something that I consider to be different, but I still consider it to be odd or bad, or, you know, fill in the appropriate word. And so I think it needs to go a step further to actually be open to understanding, creating empathy, as you said, Nicole, to, you know, that group or that person or that belief system that just might be different from yours.
Yeah, I do agree with the sentiment that is being shared. I'm very, very optimistic about where the wearable technology market is heading. I think to have access to what we have now, even 5 years ago, seemed quite impossible. And having such rich data requires the users to have a level of responsibility as well as autonomy of their own data. And I think this conversation has really positioned consumers as well as investors in the theme of the conversation itself, which was incentive alignment. And that's really what I think will be driving this new era of technology forward, is how do we use biometric data to enhance human intelligence, enhance human performance, human connection, and then how do we leverage that in a way that benefits both investors and consumers alike. So that's you know, the vision that I would like to leave our listeners with.
Thank you both. You know, I think our listeners know how I feel about all of these topics, because I feel like I'm constantly standing on a mountaintop screaming about it. But to close up this conversation, one of the things that comes to mind is actually the last guest I had on the podcast, the Honorable Jan Owen, who actually sits on our company advisory board. She cited something that was really actually quite impactful for me to hear, which was we were talking about the influence of these technologies on children, because her work along the course of her career has been adolescent rights. And she said, you know, many, many studies are showing that even with the influence of technology, the thing that influences our young people the most in terms of life direction is their parents still. And it sounds obvious, right? Like, of course, the parent is going to have the biggest kind of influence in the child's life. But for whatever reason, that actually took me back a little bit, because I think I had an assumption that in today's world, technology was influencing the minds of our young people potentially even more than parents. And what it reminded me of was, you know, you can get lost down any which echo chamber or rabbit hole, but at the end of the day, human connection and our families and those closest to us are the ones that have the biggest influence over the course of our life, the trajectory of our lives. And I feel like it's an appropriate thing to leave this conversation on today is a reminder to all of our listeners to recognize the power that you have to positively influence the lives of the people that you love, irrespective of any of, you know, the different concerns we might collectively share around the direction of companies and technology, that actually the greatest point of influence is how we relate to one another in an everyday context. So it's been a pleasure, you two. As always, we'll put the resources in the show notes and make sure that you guys jump onto the video and answer any of the questions that come up for our listeners, because I know they'll be keen to hear. Or if you're listening, make sure you reach out to Kaushik and Marqueza personally. Let them know how the episode impacted you and the boards that you joined as a result of listening to these last couple of conversations. But we're going to leave it there today. Thank you, Kaushik and Marqueza.
Thank you, Kaushik and Nicole. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Thanks, everyone.